Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, beginning of October 2019. I want to take a minute to thank my donors. There are plenty of times where you guys are really the only reason that I keep going, both literally and metaphorically, because obviously without you, I couldn't function. And so, you know, this, the financial disaster that was put into in 2014, of course, is not going away. And it gets deeper as time goes on, and there's all these other issues going on. And the truth is, as I said before, is that because of you and everyone who's helped put the show on the air, I've done what everyone said was impossible. And that is, I've led and am leading a fully free academic life outside of any institution, which is extremely rare. And that's on you guys, and I appreciate it. Now this, we've touched on this topic many times before, because it's something that I know that my listeners want to hear about, and is of such immense significance, and I'm always coming across new material. It's probably going to be a two-part series. We'll see how far I get. I never get as far as I think I'm going to. The problem being that I know too much. When you know too much, you go off on tangents, and, you know, that's just how it is. But so it'll probably be a two-parter. And it comes from some of the written work of Ambrose von Sievers. He's an old believer, intellectual and eccentric. He's the guy that they accused of printing that Hitler icon. And when I met him and I asked him, the first thing I asked him, and he said, absolutely not. So you just can't, you know, how these things snowball over time. You can't believe anything that you read. An icon of a man who wasn't Orthodox, is absurd. And for an old believer, a traditionalist like him, it's even more absurd. So, you know, and this is a very common thing. They have Photoshop pictures and all this stuff. And it's day to day for us. Now, he's an eccentric like a lot of us. But he's written some interesting things. And I think they deserve a bit more, attention. And I'm using some of his work, which has never been translated, as a foundation for my own material. But, one of the great things that he's done, I think he's in Sweden now. I haven't spoken to him in a while. Is that he has access to sources. You have to be on the ground within the true Orthodox, you know, catacomb movement in Russia to get your hands on. And so he has insights that most people simply don't have access to. Now, both on this show and in writing, especially in writing, I've spoken about Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia's support, not only for Hitler, but National Socialism more abstractly. And, of course, the very famous letter, June 12, 1938, of Metropolitan Anastasi, the head of the organization, isn't just a matter of giving thanks for him. He rebuilt the Berlin Cathedral, made sure that a very good Metropolitan, Seraphim Laid, who I've had several broadcasts on now, who was the head of the Russian Orthodox Church in the Reich. And he had the church, you know, rebuilt and repaired. And the situation of the Russian church in Germany regularized. And, of course, Seraphim Laid was a German. I think he was from the Baltics. And was a convert. And he became, he was fluent in German. And he became the head of the church in as far as the German Reich would extend. Which is an odd way to put it, but that's what it was. You know, these aren't normal times, so you're not going to get normal situations. I've spoken about him in at great length, and very little of his writing is even available anymore. But the letter that he wrote is not just about, you know, thanking him for something, or that it was from his own money, or that you know it rebuilt a parish. It was deeper than that. He says this. He says, "We know from reliable sources that a believing Christian Russian people, moaning under the yoke of slavery and waiting for its deliverer, constantly offer prayers to God that he will save you," he's writing Adolf Hitler here, "guide you and give you his all-powerful help. Your tremendous feat for the German nation and the greatness of the German Empire has made you an example worthy of imitation and an example of how to love your people, your homeland, how to stand for your national treasure and the eternal values that they represent. For even these latter find their sanctification and perpetuation in our church." So, and he, you know, he has many, and he was saying this right until the end of the war. And now that was that was very early. That was in 1938, and of course it came back to haunt him. But of course, he was saying this in 1944. And of course, other people who were under him were saying very similar things. The Epistle of the Orthodox Russian People, the meeting of the Synod Abroad, October 12, 1943. The long-standing, close rapprochement, the communist government headed by the bloody tyrant, Stalin, with a sufficient number of Jews participate, fanatically despising Christianity and mercilessly exterminating the Russian people, cast a gloomy shadow in the faith of this new patriarch, this when Sergius was elected, whom our conscience doesn't allow to call us a true father or spiritual leader. This is the kind of thing that he consistently spoke of. He says, "Our struggle against communism is with atheism. By very nature, our war against it should be persistent and irreconcilable. There is no neutrality in this area. For he who is not with Christ is against him." The Synod of Bishops from Belarus said this. Anastasi says in his Nativity Epistle in 1944, "Woe to those who do not fully share their destructive views and lusts, lends them a helping hand, binds their fate with them, and alliance with dark forces never goes unpunished. Any flame can scorch one who frivolously plays with and touches with his own hands. Tempted in hypocrisy and cunning, such sages are mistaken if they think that you'll be able to neutralize this destructive fire that destroyed Russia for themselves. Such a task may be higher or greater than your strength. Blood always gives birth to blood, and fire ignites fire. It's already obvious to everyone that those who ignited this current fire or rejoice in its spread can neither stop nor much less extinguish it. The current fateful events are developing with some kind of uncontrollable elemental force and ready to carry everyone into the abyss. We're all anxiously approaching the brink of this new year, not knowing what it will bring. Will it bring a moral renewal of mankind, and the enlightenment of the mind, softening of the heart, and with them an appeasement of God and other graces?" Of course, he's referring to the victory in the war, which seemed more remote in 1944. "Or will it bring a deepening of our ulcers and ailments and new heavenly punishments that will pour out like the apocalyptic seven vials of God's wrath, with a land flourished, washed with tears and purified by sufferings, God's grace with the bloom of peace and happiness? Or will it turn to some animal kingdom where wild people will wander among the gloomy deserts and ruins, inspiring fear and horror in their very appearance? I could go on. He is consistently showing Adolf Hitler as not just the hammer against Stalin, but as a cleansing fire. Of course, he's not an Orthodox guy, but that what he's built in Germany is a model for everybody else. And he says that in his initial 1938. As the war dragged on, he began to realize that this was a bit of a problem. In 1944, the end of 1944, he gave a speech to the Russian National Liberation Movement. Of course, were essentially a National Socialist Russian military organization against Bolshevism. You're really the ninth hour. And he says, "And since you, dear brothers, you strive to crush this terrible evil, because you're fighting for the triumph of light against darkness, truth against lies, freedom against violence, Christianity and culture against abuse and the destruction of the human person, you created a truly patriotic, a world cause, and the church cannot but bless your great and holy endeavor. To you, the heroes of the spirit, you're destined to accomplish the great work of liberating the motherland, if only you go along the path of honor, truth, and selfless achievement. Your brothers and sisters will unite around this national liberation movement of ours, and each will strive to work our own way and contribute to the common great cause of the liberation of our motherland." Now, he says this is the journal, The Will of the People, from November 22nd, 1944. And then in 1948, one of the most odd epistles that Anastasia ever wrote, and I can't say I've seen it before. He's talking about nuclear weapons. And he says, now remember, this is 3 years after the war. He says, "Our time has invented its own means of extermination of all life on Earth. And these forces can turn large space into desert. This terrible, devastating fire is not only destructive, but it also has a cleansing effect. It burns those who ignite it, and with it all the vices, crimes, and passions with which they defile the earth. Imagine that modern Caligula and Nero, all tyrants, lecherous murderers, would not be struck by death. Life on earth would be unbearable. There is an immutable divine law according to which evil itself bears its retribution. But you will say that the exterminating sword of death falls not just on the corrupt and evil, on the virtuous people, even the saints, the latter even more so than the former. But for such people, death is not a disaster, for the path is open to them for an endless, blissful, true life acquired for us by the death and resurrection of Christ. Atomic weapons, invented by modern technology, are truly less dangerous for our country than the moral decay that the highest representatives of civil and church authorities bring to Russia. The decomposition of an atom brings only physical devastation and destruction, and the corruption of the mind, heart, and will entails the spiritual death of an entire nation, after which there is no resurrection." And that was published in the journal Holy Russia, April 1948, in Stuttgart. This is an extremely eccentric thing. It's been argued that he's arguing for a nuclear attack on Russia, and that even if certain innocent people are killed, that it's far better than the situation that exists now. I'm not entirely sure that that's what he's saying here, but it's very, very easy to take that from it. Though I've never come across this before. And he cites Jeremiah. Of course, you go to the prophets for these things all the time. And he quotes Jeremiah 12. He says, "How long will the land lie parched and the grass and every field be withered? Because those who live in it are wicked, and animals and birds have perished. Moreover, the people are saying, God will not see where we're headed." Now, that last line has numerous translation problems, but that's essentially it. That because of the evil of the system, the land is destroyed. And that absolutely was the case in the USSR. Now, the problem for him is that Hitler lost. And at the time, he was in Vienna, and then moved to Munich and Bavaria. Now he's got a problem. He was known not only as a supporter of Hitler, as a supporter of National Socialism, at least in a general sense. National Socialism, it's not fascism. Those are two different ideologies. And you know, like what would be the Iron Guard or the Greek version or the Austrian version. You know, there's very different approaches here. But there's also the possibility that he's going to be sent to the Soviet Union. He knows that he's in a very vulnerable state. So in October of 1945, he then clarifies, so to speak, what he has said many times in the past. And he says, I'm not going to quote it directly, but in essence, he says that, well, we were so frightened, and Hitler was the only game in town. And so, well, we figured out that he was going to destroy Ukraine and Crimea and everything else, and he hated the Russian people and everything else, so we turned on him. Then in 1947, he even goes so far as to say that the 1938 address, where he, you know, ideologically, you know, makes himself one with Hitler, he says that he didn't even approve of the additions that had been given, and he wanted to change it. He just wanted to say thank you and nothing more than this. But somehow, that letter got through. Now, you can't blame the man for being frightened. Obviously, he was extremely upset, knowing full well that there is a chance that they may arrest him as an enemy and send him back to the Smersh units. He was in Munich until 1950. Now, the above is not true. What he stated here is simply false. I could go on and on about what not just Anastasi said, but bishops under him and official publications and everything else, support of National Socialism and nationalism in every conceivable respect, over and over again. Of course, with an Orthodox foundation. But now, he's upset here and distancing himself from this and claiming that I didn't even mean it. The wrong draft got sent out. So, again, I'm not judging the man. He knew what was going to happen to him if he was sent back, but this is the only reason. He absolutely must have been absolutely terrified at the time. Now, that leads to the main thrust of what I'm doing here. And that is the relationship of the true Orthodox, the Catacomb Orthodox Church, with National Socialism during the war. The true Orthodox, the Catacomb Church, the abbreviation is really the best is IPH. The abbreviation doesn't translate well, but IPH is the best you can do. Is the underground Orthodox Church that was extremely large, decentralized, of course, but made up of militant anti-communists, no doubt in the millions, who lived a completely parallel life, constantly facing the gulags at any moment. When Hitler invaded, they became, that particular group, became absolutely invaluable. The Catacomb Church absolutely welcomed them, and their publications were just explosive. When these guys were drafted, they didn't resist the draft. They immediately deserted to the Germans, which is not that easy to do. There was a rumor that Germans would pay for if you could bring over, you know, officers dead or alive. But this is very difficult to do. The Schmerz organization was formed just to deal with things like this. But one of the problems that comes up when you talk about this stuff is some of Hitler's errors in making enemies where he should have made friends, as I've been saying for 20 years. Much of it had to do with people dressing in German uniforms and committing atrocities. There's no doubt in my mind that Erich Koch was a Soviet agent, which is why Stalin specifically interceded that he not be executed. And he actually was a war criminal in this case. The Germans initially, especially the army, trusted this particular branch of orthodoxy. The Third Reich stressed the national elements of churches, the nationally oriented church organization. In the Baltic states, the Germans supported Metropolitan Sergius Okresensky, who actually, believe it or not, although fully National Socialist, remained in communion with Stalin's church organization. I'm still foggy in how he was able to do that, but these were newly acquired territories. And he created something called the Pskov Orthodox Mission, which was called the Orthodox Mission in the freed or liberated areas of Russia, which was the official name. And this was an institution for the revival of Orthodox life in this huge northern territory. And it would involve, you know, St. Petersburg, Pskov, and Novgorod, and, of course, the entire Baltic states. And as Metropolitan Sergius of Vilnius, Lithuania, who functioned under the political permission of the officers of the Armored Group North. And there were plenty of people who, you know, he wasn't trusted because people couldn't figure out who can get away with this. But there were open fighting between those supporting Stalin's church, which was never very large, and the much larger decentralized catacomb groups. In Ukraine and Belarus, you had situations between the national churches there and the catacomb groups. They generally didn't deal with the Ukrainian autocephalous very well. There were two bishops, Pantaleimon Rudnik and Leonti Filipovich, who ultimately ended up rejecting the Ukrainian national movement on canonical grounds, which I think was silly, because it certainly had a canonical foundation. But what began to develop in Belarus was the Bishop of Smolensk, Stefan Sevbo, who died in 1963, had rejected Metropolitan Sergius Okresensky. Remember, that's not the Sergius in Finland and then later Moscow. Now, in the central Black Earth region, North Caucasus area, you had the Cossack forces, which were still very, very strong, to a man that were part of the catacomb organization. There was an attempt to infiltrate them, but they were a very tough nut to crack. There's no question about it. There was a battle between the catacomb groups and the so-called renovationists, or the surgeons, which got bloody a lot of the time. The Germans were almost afraid to intervene. Nicholas Amasia, who died in 1945, emerged as a bishop of these traditionalist groups, and the Germans permitted him to organize a diocesan administration. He had been a renovationist and a communist at one point, though. But this was where, and this the Black Earth area is really where the IPH was at its strongest, even the Orel region in Bryansk. One of my favorite shows I did was on the Likud community, the National Socialist Orthodox Russian Nationalist community in the forests of Bryansk. Is one of the first ones I did for Radio Aryan a couple of years ago. I strongly recommend you revisit that, because here you have an actual social experiment, a successful one. It can only last a short time, but in its short reign was extremely successful. Now, the Cossacks in the south were the most effective. They destroyed entire Red Army units. And the anti-Bolshevik movement here was highly decentralized. There was no central organization whatsoever, except for the Synod abroad, who had been out of the country for some time. And many of them were unaware of what was going on the ground. Many Russian immigrants and repatriated Russian Germans came. And most of these guys, when they were to speak later on, said that the relationship between the German military and the Catacomb Church was extremely close, including lower-level SS people. There was a Father Nikephoros von Richter Mielen, who died in 1983, said that he baptized many Germans and married 8 couples where Russian girls were brides, which was a problem. But there was a tremendous relationship to develop between the Germans and the catacomb groups. And we all know the story. You know, they came in and the organization, the church organization, exploded. The Germans provided the underground church with weaponry. Many of them entered the local police. And they were extremely successful in fighting the NKVD. The Germans permitted, or already in 1941, catacomb churchmen enter the Wehrmacht, not only as auxiliary, but also in regular combat units. And they concentrated their forces in the Bryansk, as we already mentioned, and in the Cossack regions. And the Likud, of course, was one of the most famous in the Bryansk area. And that was in the full control of the IPH, under Voskobojnikov, and then later on, of course, the famous Kaminsky. Now, it's said that Voskobojnikov had mostly captured Red Army guys, and that simply isn't true. Most, the bulk of his army and the National Socialist government at Likud in Bryansk Forest were catacombnics, so to speak. And whenever Red Army guys came over, they had deserters all the time. A Smersh organization was not all-powerful. They were tested. Now, I don't know the details on what this test was, but it was very strict. And it was on both the connection with Orthodoxy as well as the rejection of the Soviet Union. And if they failed, they were handed over to the Germans. And then this became, 1942, the Russian Liberation People's Army, as a brigade, and very successfully participated in operations against the partisans. General B.A. Smysolovsky. Again, all of these small, decentralized organizations, which were absolutely essential to the German war effort, the Druzhina Brigade. You know, the immigrants were replaced by the Soviet military, and the catacombics wouldn't obey them. They went to the Druzhina Brigade, you know, under Gilbradinov. And after his death, they continued to fight long after the surrender was signed. And of course, they were a big part of the SS units, Brandenburg and Ruthenium. The famous tank battle of Kursk, which is just as significant as Stalingrad. And almost nowhere can you find any mention of the fact that catacomb partisans were an essential part of the war effort, not just in intelligence, not just in guerrilla tactics, but in supplies as well. Because you had combat-ready forces for the defense of Orel. And in that region, of course, the catacomb church was extremely strong. And right up to the present day, you have elderly people who remember continue to just praise and venerate the Germans that invaded the country. And it wasn't just because Stalin was driven away, but because they created their own institutions. And the Kursk battle, the Germans had a chance because the local Russian population was absolutely essential to the war effort. Now, the NKVD punitive bodies in the ORL region, they took a chunk out of this. And the Russian refugees during each German retreat, you know, it got bigger and bigger as time went on. And so whole communities of the Catacomb Church left for the West. And so, but they were given, they had German-issued weaponry, and they performed a lot of rearguard battles. The Schema Bishop Leonti Mirminkov died in 1989, spoke of the services that were held in Russian units for the start of each battle during the Kursk salient. There's German soldiers who said that they seemed plunged into the Middle Ages, in a very good way, into a much healthier age when they were around these people. The connection between the two groups was personal. The problem developed when the NKVD began to infiltrate some of these groups. Part of the problem that split the German military and the Orthodox was because of what essentially the Smersh organization was able to do. The ROA, of course, one of the liberation movements, you had A.V. Trukula, the Russian Corps, you had General B.A. Stefan, and they never trusted General Vlasov. And part of it was, again, this constant ability of the NKVD to penetrate their forces. Attempts to subjugate some of the old believer Bishop Makary, for example, was absolutely destructive. And it was Sergius Vicenti who threatened the guy. And his monastery was split in pieces. Maybe two-thirds supported Sergius, a third supported Makary. And Vladika John Loshkov, who died in 1945. All of which were members of the underground church. Bishop Makary of Vasilev did not die during a bombing in Holy Week in 1944. He was killed by Sergian monks. And this comes up now and again, but it's not very well known. The end, of course, was tragic. Many fled to the West. And there was fighting between the soldiers of the SS under Kaminsky and the Vlasovites. The Vlasovites, according to them, had been deeply penetrated. And they wanted to combine the Kaminsky unit with Vlasov, and nothing good absolutely came of that. The ROA was approved on the basis of the Kaminsky SS division, but only a few left the rest remained in the SS. The catacombnics who served in Russian units were really the backbone near the end. They kept Germans from surrendering over and over again. You had both German testimony as well as Russian testimony at the time. And they were known for, even after the war was over, they continued the fight in the forest. The repressions against the catacombnics were extraordinary. After the war was over, they were treated in the harshest possible way. You had those, you know, a lot of the catacomb communities were simply shot. Others were sentenced to the gulag. Wherever the punitive bodies came, the Smershniks, and their hunt for the catacombs, like Archimandrite Daniel Klimova. And I should note, you know, the Smersh, the Stalinist organization, whose sole purpose was to subvert these organizations. They were attacking German forces to infiltrate the Red Army on the Eastern Front. The word is an abbreviation, death to spies. Initially it was called death to German spies, but Stalin said, well, you shouldn't stop with Germans. So the GUGB, the main directorate of state security, was then completely reorganized. So these guys had a very, very specific portfolio. Smerish, 1943, used German agents to spread disinformation about the Kursk counteroffensive. And they spread all this information. The Red Army was digging in rather than going on the offensive. Smerish caught, and they turned a number of German agents who then tricked the German military in numerous sources that they ended up underestimating the number of Soviet troops by almost 2 million men from these successful radio broadcasts. And the Smerish organization was put in charge of finding Hitler's body after the war. They found Hitler's, at least I guess it was his corpse, after his suicide, and they did confirm the events and the remains. And apparently, they buried him at the Smerish headquarters near Magdeburg. And then eventually, in 1970, he was exhumed and then completely cremated. It was headed by Viktor Abakumov, who, by the way, shot in 1954 on the grounds that he was a Stalinist and part of the doctor's plot. So Viktor Abakumov, one of the most unlucky men in history. If he had refused Stalin's promotion, he would have been shot. Because he accepted it, he was shot. So he had absolutely no chance. But one of the things that the Smerish, because these were particularly ideological groups, they crucified. They actually used crucifixion. Father Moses, Father Theodore near Riga, Father Hermann in Poland, Alexei in Breslau, Father Paul in East Prussia. There's four unknown Cossack priests in Austria. All told, in 1945, about 100 priests were dealt with in this way. Now, those who were sent to the Gulag, the average sentence was 25 years, which essentially was a life sentence. The odd thing was, they noticed that the Vlasovites were almost never shot, and they were given relatively light terms in the Gulag. And it got so bad that some of the catacomb were going to the Smerish, calling themselves Vlasovites, changing their uniforms and everything. So all of a sudden, this organization grew very large, because if they said they were in the ROA, they were in a lot of trouble. But all that generation is dying. That catacomb, the entire catacomb movement, looked to Hitler as somebody who, well, not orthodox, of course, and made many errors, was a harbinger of social justice in general. 1943, a group of hermit monks in the Caucasus, they guided German units going along the mountains, which, of course, very difficult going. They protected pilots who were shot down. They bandaged the wounded. They were infiltrated in 1944. All the hermits were shot by Smerish people. Now, I've heard five young monks escaped with two wounded German soldiers, one of whom converted. And then one of them became Hero Deacon Alexei of the Special Pravdensky Monastery in Abkhazia. So there's still tremendous support for Germany among the catechumens. But there was a movement where, and it was really one of the more unhealthy things that you can deal with in these situations. And the movement was that resistance to evil by force was a problem. And this was a demonic doctrine. Somehow Tolstoy had infiltrated the church. And you still have this today, you have this all over the world, Orthodox people who, you know, not only do they believe that resistance is somehow sinful, but even engaging in politics is sinful rather than a requirement. And of course, there were people, you know, in the immigration who recognized the perniciousness of this doctrine. And that's why Ivan Illin wrote On the Resistance to Evil by Force, which got the imprimatur from the Synod Abroad. In 1925, he wrote to Struve. He said, in Berlin, Tikhonum and Metropolitan Anthony, from Berlin, consider my book to be true and accurate expression of the Orthodox view. Now in 1921, you had an ex-socialist, a journalist, S.A. Solokov, along with the Duke, Leuchtenberg, and of course the famous Cossack P.N. Krasnov, created the Brotherhood of Russian Truth. Now it was a militant political movement. It was firmly, National Socialist in every sense of the term. BRP, it was normally called. And they were constantly, I mean, the Civil War never ended for these guys. They were constantly engaging in a border war against the Soviets. But they were a strongly religious institution. And Metropolitan Anthony Krapovitsky was a direct patronizer of it. And he issued a special blessing for the Brotherhood. And he said in July of 32, Metropolitan Anthony wrote to the Supreme Council, "Brothers of the Russian truth, dear in Christ, today I received your friendly message. My gratitude and prayer and sympathy, I offer you my common prayer for all the ascetics of the Russian idea. I am confident your kind disposition towards me, for the salvation of Russia and the prosperity of the faith, is to be bright hope for victory over enemies and orthodoxy in the belief that with you, the souls of all your honest compatriots eagerly follow the progress of your affairs, rejoice at your successes, and pray for your souls, both deceased and living." And he wasn't alone in this regard. The BRP was an NS group. The appeal of the Brotherhood at Brotherhood of St. Job, Opochia. I say, "The mercy of God and blessing of Almighty be with you, dear fighter, for the liberation of our long-suffering motherland. You do a great and sacred work. Only do it as a sacred service to the cross of Christ, the Church of Holy Russia. This holy work is to be done with pure feelings, and the belief that this is a just and saving matter, and will always inspire you in the most difficult moments of life. We commemorate daily before the throne of the Almighty your names that are dear to us. We will print the prayer for Russia," and their journal was the Orthodox Carpathian newspaper, "published for the mission. Your information, like with the religious life and struggle in Russia, we'll be happy to post and to talk about. You send us a list of the dead, remember them. Your well-wisher and pilgrim, rector of the Orthodox Missionary Convent St. Job, Pochev, Archimandrite Vitali, with the Brotherhood." But you had the Russian Fascist Union, which was an Orthodox body. And of course, even there, the RFU had full church support. Patriarch Barnabas of Serbia, 1935, said, "May God save you and your Brotherhood in complete health and prosperity, and soon give you all the joy to see your new homeland again. I'm sending my patriarchal blessing, wishing strength and wisdom for a successful and friendly service to the Russian cause." Archbishop Miletius, 1934, and he's talking about their newspaper, which is called Our Way. He said, "Lays the foundation for the struggle for the liberation of the Russian people from foreign powers. I wish all your fighters for this work success with God's blessing." Then Archbishop Nestor, in 1934, "God grant that all people recognizing the horror of the storm that broke out in our motherland, the consciousness of their mistakes, with repentance, and spiritual enlightenment, would take this path, your path, and go to their native soil. With love, I appeal to your good deeds, the Russian newspaper and its leaders. God's blessing, Archbishop Nestor." So this was official doctrine. And it's tragic to see what Anastasi was kind of forced to say when he had to backtrack on all of this. And he sounded foolish. I mean, no one can blame him, of course. He would have done no one any good being sent back in a keelhaul or anything else. And this is where, of course, the idea began to develop. Maybe we should, you know, leave Europe. And it was bad enough that they were initially in Vienna and then in southern Germany. They were right in the middle of everything. and it was no secret what side they were on. It's an endless list of people in the church at the time who supported every conceivable form of nationalism. Of course, blame the Jews for the situation, at least, you know, Jewish elites for the situation in the early Bolsheviks, and saw Hitler as this avenging fire. And there's far too much to even fit into one talk. Now, in his appeal in 1943 to the bishops' conference in Vienna, of course, people began to realize that Metropolitan Seraphim Lukanov was one of the dominant personalities there in 43 and in 44. We're coming close to the end of the war, and he said we need to intensify our prayer for the victory of the Germans. And of course, full support for another one of these armed formations, the so-called Russian Security Corps. Before the start of every battle, there needs to be services. And of course, I had a special letter from Metropolitan Anastasia, which we only know secondhand. And he compared the soldiers of this body with St. George and the Judeo-Bolshevik Hydra and everything else, which was very typical for, you know, what they said at the time. And he was completely uncompromising in terms of the resistance to evil by force. And that, you know, Easter message of 1948 that I mentioned. And as it turns out, the Synod Abroad never officially published this because of what he said in it. Now, von Sievers, a lot of others say, yeah, he was calling for a nuclear strike against the USSR and that the deaths of people, are nothing compared to what they're going through right now. One of my favorite statements was made by the secretary of the Synod, a guy whose name is, I don't even think he could pronounce it. He's Georgian. And I mean, how many Georgians do you know? As custodian, Makaro Bizde. And the Stavropol Council, the temporary council, derived in 1919. He was a Georgian, of course. He was born in the Caucasus. He went to the theological seminary, but he studied law at St. Petersburg University. But then he entered the military spiritual department of the army, and he became the proto-presbyter of the military, the naval clergy. And he served as a clerk in the so-called marching church. And then in the exile, he became the secretary of the Synod, and he was the editor of the Church Journal, the Church Herald. And then in the 50s, he was a member of the secretary of the Episcopal Council of the German Diocese of the Synod Abroad under Bishop Alexander. He died in 1960. So being editor of the paper and being secretary of the Synod, when he writes in an official publication, is official doctrine. And what he writes is one of the harshest, and I think, It had the imprimatur of the bishops at the time, and certainly Anastasia. But he says, a special joy awaits us. This is, by the way, it's called On the Anniversary of the Crusade, June 22nd, 1942. And all these citations I'm giving, I'm only bits and pieces of them. I can't do the whole thing, but these are just the more significant parts of them. He says, a special joy embraces us, and the knowledge that we finally waited for that moment that we've been waiting for so long, and the torment and humiliation of our exiles. There's no words, no feelings, which would be possible to pour a well-deserved gratitude to the liberators and their leader Adolf Hitler, who restored freedom of religion there, returned to the faithful the temples of God that have been taken from them, and then restored their human form. And now, on the eve of the impending great offensive to the east, in order to finish the enemy to the end, I want to join the liberated, those who are still in the bonds of communism. Truth wins, he said. It's not for nothing that Providence chose the leader of the great Germany as his instrument, crushing this non-human enemy whom, in addition to the Russian people, threatened directly to the German people. He quotes Vladimir Jakubinsky, the extreme Zionist leader. And he says, the struggle against Germany has been going on for months by all Jewish religious communities, all Jewish conferences, all Jews around the world. There's reason to believe that our participation in this struggle will benefit everyone. We will initiate a war of the whole world against Germany, a material war, a spiritual war, for Jewish interests. On the contrary, require the complete destruction of Germany. And that was reprinted in Our Reich magazine in 1934 and reprinted by the World Service later on. And of course, he reprints this there. There is a Athenine elder, Father Aristocles, who was shot in Moscow when the revolution first came out. And right up until his death, very close to his death, he said, the salvation of Russia will come when the Germans take up arms. The Russian people will have to go through many humiliations, but in the end, he will be the lamp of faith for the whole world. Now, of course, he's referring to faith in strictly the political sense. He wasn't deluded into thinking that Hitler was Orthodox in any way. But one of the significant things to remember here is that you had tremendous, even amongst SS units, you had tremendous sympathy with these elements of the population. But the Smersh organization had one purpose, ultimately. And that purpose was to sow distrust. You don't need to, it's like these people who think everybody's an agent. Well, if I'm working for one of our enemies, if everyone thinks that there's agents everywhere, well, you don't need to send agents anywhere. Or, you send one once in a blue moon, and no one's going to trust each other after a while. And because people would rather call names than actually make arguments, which is a very common thing, they know it will take, a few weeks before any kind of organization is going to be torn apart. And the exact same principle was used by the Smersh organization. And Stalin was well aware of this, now that they all answered to Beria. But the NKGB was the People's Commissariat for State Security. And all told, Smersh recruited almost 4 million informants, 12% of the entire Red Army. And Smersh coerced maybe 50% of them to work for them directly. And their disinformation campaign, you didn't have to be everywhere. One of the great principles of tyranny is that you don't need to arrest every enemy. You need to arrest people for no reason. It has to be lawless and completely impossible to predict. Because then you spread fear. Then you spread this terror of the absolute unknown. Because one of these days there actually will be an agent somewhere. I mean, I don't know why they'd waste the money, but, there's simply no need for it. But you don't need to have, there was tens of millions of combatants here. Anyone could be an informant. And they were extremely successful, and they could fool. And so, I've always been very hard on German intelligence. They made some critical errors. But at the same time, the Smersh organization was able to fool them over and over again. If there's one documented case of, a Smersh agent in a church body, that's all it takes. Now everyone's at each other's throats. Because now we know this is true, so now it could be anybody. So they could have had the exact same, in fact, they did have the same effect with a relatively few number of people. Most of these informants were not exactly full-time agents. They had a substantial organization, but they realized in terms of the psychological element of it, it was just the unpredictability of it that mattered. And it saves you a heck of a lot of money. If you arrest every single person that irritates you, then you realize you just don't irritate them. And there's always ways you could get around the law. You could get around bureaucratic protocols. That's the problem with words. No, it's when words don't matter. It's when someone just gets pulled off the street for absolutely no reason. That's when people start killing each other. And this is exactly what Smersh did, and with a great level of success. And to this day, in some, you know, Russian parishes, Old Believers most certainly, and catacomb parishes, it takes a lot of work to earn their trust. I did it with the Ukrainians back in grad school in Lincoln. They were very elderly, you know, they were Ukrainians from Poland. They'd been in Remagen. And, you know, some, you know, American kid from New Jersey just shows up one day. And it took a little while. Okay, they did nothing in English. And I learned Ukrainian this way. Eventually, you know, I even had a key to the church at one point. You know, so it's very difficult. And sometimes you go to these parishes, you feel isolated and you feel like they don't care. That's not what's going on. This is how they were raised. You know, some American kid shows up to their church out of nowhere, they're going to be suspicious. It's groundless. But there's ground for it, at least in the sense that many years ago, the trauma has completely scarred their ability to understand people in this respect. And it takes a long time to finally earn their trust. So, this is a lot of information. Let me summarize it as best as I can. The Orthodox Church outside of the Soviet Union overwhelmingly supported Hitler on military grounds and most certainly on ideological grounds. They saw no reason. I mean, obviously, he wasn't Orthodox. He wasn't going to save them in a spiritual way, and no one ever believed that. This wasn't a religious idea. You know, this is a simple matter of military necessity. When you have people in Metropolitan Anastasi talking about this ideological, philosophical salvation of Russians coming from him, and the greatness of the German Empire that he mentions, and the social justice that he witnesses around him, you have Metropolitan Vitaly Ustinov talking about that, you know, the royal principle can be found in people like Franco and Salazar and Metaxas. The National Socialist idea, and to a lesser extent the fascist idea, was the militant organization that people living in fear absolutely needed. That's what these organizations came from. They realized that capitalism was a miserable failure. They realized that Soviet socialism was a disaster. And so they built in their being crushed between two powers the only way that they could defend themselves. And this ultimately is where ideology comes from in the first place. And economically, it was tremendously successful. Now, Germany is the obvious case. And any country that associated themselves with Germany at the time was equally, we talked about this in the Yugoslavia case. The connection with Germany was a matter of financial necessity. Metropolitan Anastasi attempted to distance himself from a lot of his statements, primarily because Hitler lost. And he was absolutely terrified because he was aware that the Americans, you know, longtime allies and saviors of the Soviet Union over and over again, from the revolution on down, had every intention of sending them back. Don't forget, I have the FBI files of all these guys when they came to America. They all had FBI tails. And the grounds were that they were fascists of some kind. They were Hitlerites. And it didn't make any difference what their views of National Socialism were specifically. But every one of these people, Solzhenitsyn included, has a gigantic FBI file. And Solzhenitsyn was well aware. And he became secretive, not just, of course, you know, in being suspicious of those who may be working for the Soviet Union, but equally suspicious of American authorities, knowing full well, especially when detente came into existence under Brezhnev, that under Nixon, that they were going to hand that information over to the KGB. People forget how massively invested Western capitalism was in the Soviet Union, that they were constant economic trade and education and exchanges hourly with the USSR from every major American firm. One of the things that Joe McCarthy was going to do that he never had a chance to do was expose this once and for all. I'm absolutely convinced that the main reason that they brought him down, the government agencies brought him down, was because he was about to expose the fact that American capital built the USSR. Now, the information is undeniable in the 3-volume work by Anthony Sutton. There's no getting out of it because these are all nothing more than internal corporate documents. They were everywhere, including Henry Ford. The entire industrial foundation of the Soviet Union comes from American and Western capital, even during the Depression. And this fact wasn't lost on these activists, these Russians who had no love for the U.S. except for the simple fact that they were permitted to settle in New York City and elsewhere, but otherwise never trusted the system that had far more in common with Moscow than they ever did with these people. Soviet socialism and postmodern capitalism are almost identical ideologies. The only real difference, as I said in an interview last night, the Soviets had a tendency to be crude and use force, while the postmodern capitalist has a tendency to use seduction. And that's the big difference. Anyway, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.